Welcome to the podcast of Trinity Church London. You're listening to a message given on a Sunday morning. If you'd like to know more about us and the life of the church, please visit trinitychurchlondon.com.
If it's your first time in church, then can I just commend you? It is not easy, I don't think, to walk into church for the very first time. Hopefully, regardless, you would have recognised at least one or two of the songs that we sung this morning. Now, speaking of which, a lot of those songs are very lovely, you know, they're very quaint, they talk about things like unspeakable joy, peace, hope, but these things can feel fairly abstract. And I want to ask you a question this morning and start there. Where do you place your hope? Where do you place your hope? And I actually mean this question sincerely because I look at the world around me and frankly I'm terrified. You know, I see a world which is full of conflict. I see a world in which humanity is constantly at odds with each other. For different reasons, whether it's religion, whether it's politics, it doesn't seem to matter. There is this constant conflict in the world. And I don't think it's just true at a macro level. I think individually, we can kind of sense this time that we're living in. You know, things just seem to be harder than they were a few years ago. Even before COVID, things just seemed a little bit easier. You know, today we've got downward mobility. You know, people are struggling to pay their bills. We've got a lot of challenges around heating and all kinds of things. Just personally, we just feel this kind of conflict going on. And at the same time, there seem to be a myriad of answers all around us. You know, you've got Elon Musk, who's going to apparently one day take us all into space and we're going to live on Mars. You know, you've got other people who are building bunkers under the ground just in case the world comes to a nuclear end. And you've got these kind of glimmers of hope. But something about them just doesn't feel that hopeful. I want to start with a bit of an example. It was almost exactly 52 years to the day, actually yesterday, that a chap called Eugene Kerman, who was the commander of the Apollo 70 mission, as he was leaving the moon for the last time, said this: "As we leave the moon at Taurus Littoro, we leave as we came, and, God willing, as we shall return, with peace and hope for all mankind." And back then, there was this sense that somehow this crazy space race, this crazy kind of mission to the moon was some kind of way of uniting humanity together behind a common purpose. And there felt for the first time that there was actually some sense of peace. You know, the Cold War was still going on, there was still conflict in the world, but it felt like we could get behind it. And it took 33 years for man to actually return into outer space with the Artemis project. But somehow the tone had changed. It was no longer about, you know, adventure, science, breaking this kind of the edges of engineering. It was about survival. And to me, that doesn't really feel like hope. That feels more like desperation. And I think in some way we all sense that, right? We all sense that these things that we put our hope in just aren't quite enough. Like, we're never quite getting enough from them. They just, things just feel a bit desperate. And I think the big question we need to ask ourselves this morning is, what if Christmas really is the answer? What if hope really is to be found in a baby lying in a manger wrapped in swaddling cloth, born 2,000 years ago? What if that is true? Would that be the hope that we're looking for? Matthew, who wrote this passage, believes so. I believe so. As we join Matthew at this pivotal moment in history, we're going to look at the man of Jesus. We're going to look at what Matthew describes him as and these names that he gives to him, Emmanuel and Jesus. Quick question, does anyone here have a name that was given to them for a specific reason? Beyond their parents just liked it or you're named after potentially a family member, has anyone got a name with a significant meaning?
Yes.
Oh, I did not know that. To share.
Smurf. Because I looked like a Smurf when I was a kid.
Profound. Deep. I'm glad we started there. Anyone else? Was anyone else called? Yeah?
Richard the Lionheart, the King of England. Courage and strength that I would eventually live up.
Gosh. We're really kind of scraping the barrel here, aren't we? Claire and I had fun choosing names a few years ago, and we ended up landing on this name, Esme, and Esme was the one running around like a headless chicken, as she always does. And we kind of did the usual thing when parents do this. We kind of shortlisted a bunch of names, we kind of went through them, we looked up the meaning, and then we threw them all out, and we started again, and we shortlisted a bunch of names, and eventually we landed on this one, Esme, which it turns out means blessed. And we were like, sorry, I got it wrong. Beloved, sorry. Gosh, this is really starting to work. Now, the point I was going to make was simply this. We fell in love with the name first. The meaning was nice, but it was never the reason we chose it. And yet, that's probably true for most of us here, I think, apart from obviously Daniel and Richard the Lionheart over there. You know, most of us were given our names simply because they're nice names. And yet, if you go back long enough, names have profound significance. So in the UK, you're probably familiar with names like Smith, like Cartwright. Now, those names originally were occupational. That's what our ancestors would have done, and that's why we record them. And the Bible is no different. The Bible uses names, and those names have significance. So I'm just going to give you four very simple examples of names that either represent someone's nature, something about their life, their heart, or their work. So Adam, who we believe was the first created man made from the earth, his name Adam means earth. Job, if you've not read the story of Job, I'll leave out the story itself and you can guess why he's called this, but it means he who weeps, which is very, very pertinent. Peter, upon which Jesus said, I'm going to build the church, his name means rock. And Paul, who wrote many of the letters in the New Testament, his name means humble. And so you see how these names mean something. They have deeper meaning than just their being nice names. And so when Matthew gives us not one but two names, we need to ask ourselves, what is the significance of these names? Emmanuel, which means God with us, and Jesus. Do they start to tell us something about God's heart and about the nature of his work? So we're going to explore these two names. The first, Emmanuel, is a Hebrew name. Now it's made up of two parts, Emmanuel and El, which basically means with us and God. So together, God with us, quite simple. Now for most of us, the significance of that is almost entirely lost. And I think it's for a very simple reason, because we grow up, you know, regardless of whether you grew up in church, we grow up with the nativity, right? Christmas reminds us every year of this little baby called Jesus. He was in a manger, he was surrounded by sheep and shepherds and wise men and all the amazing little helpers that we had with us this morning. But because it has become so familiar to us, we forget the significance of this moment in time when God came to earth as a man. So when society reads us, we get caught up with something entirely different from what the Jews of the time would have got caught up with. And let me just read this. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel. And here's the thing. The bit we get stuck on, and if you're a Christian, you probably have this teased of you in the past. The bit we get stuck on is the virgin birth. You know, how is it possible that there is a miraculous birth? How is this something that is real? Now, of course, I understand the significance of that, because in our worldview, if this is true, if God did come to earth, and if Jesus himself was a miraculous birth, then there is only one rational explanation, that God is real, that Jesus is God, and that everything in the gospel is true. But at the time, the worldview believed in God. There was no doubt that the supernatural could have happened. There was no doubt that the virgin birth could have come to pass. The outrageous part of this story for the Jews of the time wasn't Mary's virginity, but it was that God would choose to come to earth as a baby at all. Now, again, I get that this is kind of lost on us, so I'm going to try and do my best to explain just how profound this would have been. The God of the Old Testament, whenever he showed up, was utterly terrifying. Okay, utterly terrifying. When God appears to Abraham in Genesis 15, there is a smoking furnace and flaming torch that passes through the sky. When the Israelites gather around Mount Sinai, God descends in fire and smoke and thunder, and we're told it's accompanied by an earthquake and sounding trumpets. In Job, God speaks out of a whirlwind, and during the dedication of Solomon's temple, God's glory appears as a marvelous cloud, and the priests, we're told, are so overwhelmed by the presence of God, they can't even perform their duties. This is the God of the Old Testament. The God of the universe, when he moved among his people, he just chose to do so in power and glory and majesty, with fire and cloud and earthquakes and sounding trumpets. This is the God who parted the Red Seas, who spoke from the burning bush. This is the God of power and significance, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Come to us as a lamb. Come to us as a lamb, a baby, fragile, entirely dependent on his mother, in the cold, in a manger, surrounded by strangers. That is why the Jews of the time would have found this so remarkable. It was not the God they expected, but it was the God they needed. Now, it's also important to note that this wasn't a second go. Okay, because it's very easy to think, well, God tried in the Old Testament. He tried through these manifestations of power and fire and wind and earthquakes and all these things, and it didn't work. But actually, we're told, as it says in verse 22, all this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. In other words, Christ is the fulfillment of that promise. It was always his intention. And what does that tell us about him? It tells us that God's heart has always been and will always be for us. Now, God wasn't satisfied to speak out of the whirlwind. He wasn't satisfied to be this sort of manifestation of fire. He wanted to be with us. And he loved us so much that when we deserted him in our pride, when we turned away from God, he chose to step down from his throne to take the form of a human in the flesh to bring us back to himself. That is the heart of God. And that is why this moment in time is so profound for us, if we choose to believe it. Now, the second name, Jesus, which is probably the one we're more familiar with. Now, the Hebrew for Jesus was Yeshua, and that's actually taken from Yehoshua, which is basically Joshua. A very common name at the time. It wasn't actually unusual in the slightest, but it literally means the Lord saves. Right? God saves. So with Emmanuel, we're told something of God's heart for us, and with Jesus, we're told something about his work, how he fulfills this desire to bring us back to himself. Now, I want to tell you my story, because sometimes these things are just helpful to punctuate with our own life experience. And I grew up in a Christian home. Right? As a kid, I went to church. I was, you know, pretty much every week. I was kind of like a reasonably good kid. I knew the rules. Vaguely stuck to them. I was cheeky, so I'm told, but I was never particularly naughty. A bit like Esme, really. And as I grew older, the relevance of church just started to disappear. You know, I never quite understood this story of grace, the story of God, and over time, I just, you know, kind of got a bit fed up with it. You know, this God that I've been reading about, this God of fire, this God who had parted the Red Seas to let his people pass, this God never seemed to show up for me. You know, this God seemed to be quiet. He seemed to be distant. Where is the God of the Old Testament, I thought? Where is the, you know, when there's conflict, why is he not coming down with, you know, fires and lightning? And I was like, where is this God? I just didn't sense him. And therefore, I just thought, well, this is just a bit irrelevant. And actually, I don't ever think I doubted God existed. But the truth be told, I just thought God was distant. I just didn't think he cared about me, and I frankly didn't care about him. And the other massive inconvenience that I found was that, you know, I believed that, you know, when I was, you know, a Christian as a youth, I had to kind of follow these rules. And I found that really inconvenient, particularly when I hit my teens and when I started, you know, going to the pub and things like that. I'd feel really guilty. So on the one hand, I'd have like this sense of a distant God, and on the other hand, I'd have like this sense of guilt. And I got to the point in my life where I just thought, what is the point of just feeling guilty to please a God who doesn't seem to care? And in the end, I just walked away from it all. Fast forward 15 years, because it was 15 years, about. I don't know why I'm looking at my notes. I mean, it's my story. I should be able to recall this off the top of my head. No, fast forward 15 years, I kind of lived life my own way. And I was doing all right. You know, I had a nice house in the suburbs, had a nice car, was married, and I thought life was pretty good. I was no longer feeling guilty all the time. And actually, I thought I was pretty much a good person, you know, kind of did my bit, gave to charity every now and then, was good to my friends. You know, God just wasn't relevant to me. Didn't need him, or so I thought. And then one day, my life turned upside down. The person that I'd been with for all of my youth, my high school sweetheart, decided that didn't want to be with me anymore. She walked out, lost the house. And in a moment, my life came crashing down. And I realized just how fragile this hope, this life that I had found in all these things really was. Now, I hit rock bottom. I mean, really rock bottom. I was depressed. I was drinking every day, a lot, from the morning. Call that alcoholic, apparently. But I felt really hopeless. I felt really, really hopeless. And then for some strange reason, I just thought, you know what, I'm going to go back to church. And I don't really know what I was looking for. Maybe a friendly face. Maybe just, you know, someone to kind of make me feel a bit better. Maybe just an excuse not to drink for a few hours on Sunday morning. It's not a bad reason to go to church. But what happened changed my life. I remember it so profoundly because I'm sitting there in the back feeling kind of sheepish, you know, not really sure if I wanted to be there. And this guy, Glenn, stood up and he was preaching on the Tower of Babel. Now, if you're familiar with the Tower of Babel, it was basically the story of when, very early on in the Old Testament, when mankind in their pride decides to build up this tower and try and reach the heavens. They were so arrogant in their prowess and their engineering capability that they built this tower up, and God basically tore it down. And Glenn's point was very simply this: in our lives, we go through these phases where we build up idols for ourselves. We put our hope in these distant things, you know, whether it's our careers, whether it's our marriages, whether it's our homes, our cars, our whatever it might be. We place our hope on these things so much they become our idols, and the thought of losing them becomes terrifying. And in that moment, I realized that God himself had torn down my towers. But the bizarre thing is, I didn't feel angry. I didn't feel upset. I actually, for the first time, realized that this distant God, this God who I thought had never really cared about me, cared about me so much that he was prepared to put me through that to bring him back to himself. I felt him say in that moment, "I know this hurts, but I love you too much to live your life without me." My life started to change and turn around. It wasn't overnight. You know, I still suffered from depression for a while. I still drank too much for a while. And then I remember one day I heard the story of Grace. Actually, it was in Dubai. The church? I can't remember. But it was at our conference, our global conference, and I heard this message of grace. And for the first time, I realized that this moral standard that I'd been trying to pursue as a kid, this idea of what I thought a good human looked like, I would just put my hope in the wrong thing. I completely misunderstood the point. You see, because when you become a Christian, it's not about some kind of moral framework that you're running towards. You're not trying to find a certain standard to live your life. You're trying to find a person. And that person is Jesus. The moral standard, you can throw that away. This, I think, is the good news of Christmas. That God saves, and that he did so, coming to be with us. Coming to bring us back to himself. Now, the other thing I wanted to touch on was the fact that we can look back at this event as this monumental event in history. It was a pivotal, you know, for Christians, this is as Charles said, the pivotal moment in history. But we can't forget that it wasn't just a one-off event, right? And this is the other thing about when Jesus saves. The manner in which he saves is so profound because he doesn't leave us where we are. When he comes, when he chooses to come and be with us, when he comes to reclaim us for himself, when in our stubbornness we've walked away from him, he says, "No, do you know what? I'm going to come and get you. I'm going to come down to earth for you. I'm going to come and save you. I'm going to die on the cross for you. I'm going to bear your sins for you." He does that because he loves us, but he does that ultimately so that he can start to change us. He doesn't leave us where we are. There's this moment in Exodus 33 where Moses, who's kind of like an Old Testament prophet, He's speaking with God, and he says to God, please show me your glory. And God kind of says, well, I can't show you my face, because to see my face is to die, because I'm just too holy, I'm too righteous, and you're not. And you would die, but you know what? I'm going to show you my back. I'm going to pass you on the cliff. And he basically hides Moses on the cleft of a rock we're told. And God passes him, and Moses sees his back. And when Moses returns down from the hill, we're told that his face is alight with the glory of God. You see, when Moses saw the back of God, his face was shining. When we get to see Christ's face, our insides change. Our insides is the thing that shines. It says this in 2 Corinthians 4:6. For God, who said, let light shine out of darkness, has shone into our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. See, we're not just changed externally, we're changed on the inside. Our faces may not shine, but we shine inside. He changes us every bit, every sin, every situation, all of it. He does it all. Now, there's another point which I was meant to say about 5 minutes ago that I missed. I'm going to come back to it because it's a really important point. When I was when I sort of came back to faith, one of the things I realised is that I had thought this moral standard that I was trying to live by and in the end abandon was fine because I was good enough, you know, I was okay. I was actually a reasonably good person. But the nature of sin, right, when we forgive someone, we forgive them for what they've done to us. And what I failed to realise at the time, that being a good person, the problem with that was very simple. I'm not sinning against other people, I'm ultimately sinning against God. And so because I'm sinning against God, I do need a saviour. And what I learned through the story of grace is that God chose to come down and chose to forgive me for my sins. Not because, you know, anything I'd done, not because of any merit I had, not because of some kind of level of attainment I tried to achieve all throughout my life, but simply because he loved me. And that's ultimately the good news of Christmas. That's the hope of Christmas. Now, there's a big difference between knowing God as I did in my youth and experiencing God. There's also a difference between experiencing God's power and experiencing his person. Because the person of God, this moment in time, the fact that God chose to come to earth as a human, reveals his heart for us. It feels his longing to be with us. And his absolute desire to remove our sin from us that we might return to him. And here's the crazy thing. And this is the even bigger hope for Christmas, is that this changes the world. You know, we started by discussing this idea that actually the world around us is a pretty horrific place right now. It's a scary place. And actually we're told in Romans 8 that creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. Right? That's us when we're saved. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. In other words, God starts by saving you and I. Right? He starts within our hearts. But actually the promise that we have is that in the future, the whole earth will be redeemed. The whole earth will be brought back to God. And therefore, we don't need to worry about living on the moon in the future, or Mars, or wherever else is. We don't need to worry about digging bunkers, because we're told the whole earth will be redeemed. When Jesus died, he died for you and I, but he also died for the whole of creation. And that is the hope that we have today, that we don't need to worry about a future of doom and gloom, but we have a future of eternal life with Jesus, a future of a redeemed earth where all the world will cry in one voice, hallelujah, the Lord is with us. Let me end with a challenge, if I may. Once a year we come together and we celebrate this amazing moment in history, this time. I don't know your personal situation, I don't know if you're Christian or not. But let me ask us this, how interested are we? John Stott, who is a theologian, says this in one of his books called Basic Christianity. No one who ever met Jesus Christ, the historical figure, ever responded moderately to him. There are only three reactions to Jesus. They either hated him and wanted to kill him, they were afraid of him and wanted to run away, or they worshipped him and gave their life to him. If Jesus was born of miraculous conception, if God really is with us, then there isn't room for lukewarm. We need to stand before him and recognize that he is the one who came to earth, who saved us. We should seek him out, run to him, because he ran to us. When we ran away in our pride, he came and got us. He came to earth, giving up everything to come and reclaim us for himself. He created you. He's with you. His desire is to know you and love you. And he will do what it takes to bring you back. He is the hope for humanity. My encouragement to you this Christmas would be very simply this. If you're looking around at the world, you sense a space where you know you can do with some hope in your life. I'm not saying, you know, I'm looking for a major response. I'm not saying stand up and declare something that Jesus is Lord. I'm just saying, go and read the rest of Matthew for yourself. Google it, Matthew, Gospel. Just read it. Find out about this person, Jesus. Find out about the claims that he made. Find out about why he chose to come to earth to die for you. He's either a madman or he's the Son of God. The Bible doesn't leave any other explanation. And that's my encouragement to you.